This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
On Sunday, NBC will have a three-hour special to commemorate the 40th anniversary of Saturday Night Live. The guest list for Sunday night is long. It includes a ton of people: Chevy Chase, Steve Martin, Molly Shannon, Will Ferrell, Bill Murray, a whole bunch of others.
Since the first season, SNL has launched the careers of dozens of comedians, become a staple of American television. Here to talk about the legacy of Saturday Night Live is Nick Marks. He's an assistant professor of media studies at Colorado State University. He's also the co-editor of Saturday Night Live and American TV. Nick, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how was Saturday Night Live first received by audiences when it premiered back in 1975?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's important to remember the kind of television landscape that SNL premiered to in 1975. There are only three real options for people on television: the broadcast networks of NBC, ABC, and CBS. And they were doing something pretty different from what was routinely aired on those networks in prime time. So first off, they were in late night. They could get away with a little bit more. But that also meant that their ratings wouldn't be anywhere close to what some of the primetime juggernauts were getting, shows like All in the Family, things that would regularly attract dozens of millions of folks. So they, like I said, could get away with a little bit more, and they weren't attracting as many viewers as some of the primetime shows, but importantly, they were sort of resonating with this emerging baby boomer sensibility of comedy, one that distinguished itself from previous generations of variety shows, in particular the kind of boozy cocktail party vibe of Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In that preceded it, with which Lorne Michaels had actually written for. So they were very well received, if not in the sort of hard numbers that TV likes to traffic in. They were pretty well received among the people that they were trying to reach out to initially.
Was it a thought that, you know, this might just be an experiment that crashes and burns after a few episodes? Would anybody have had an idea that they'd be having a 40th anniversary show someday?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I think Lorne Michaels meant for the show to be sort of a limited miniseries type run initially. The show was little more than a stopgap for NBC to figure out what it wanted to do while Johnny Carson was giving up these weekend slots when they were running his reruns. I'm not sure anybody initially could have imagined that the show would keep chugging on after 40 years, but you can see the model it's set up, the sort of way that it keeps in touch with current events, with politics, the way it traffics in the celebrity of the day, the musician of the day. It really is a pretty sustainable model now that we have 40 years of hindsight to kind of look back on what it started.
You mentioned Lorne Michaels, and he still has a big hand in the show. Do you have any stories about what it was like for all of these people working with him? Everyone, it seems like, has a Lorne Michaels story.
Yeah, I'm an avid listener of Mark Maron's WTF podcast, and he's had just about every living SNL alum on that show over the podcast's run. And everybody comes on and tells their audition story. So very famously, Lauren brings people in to audition by themselves on stage, and cast members usually have to have some combination of characters and impersonations. So just about every cast member who goes through this process, whether they make it to the show or not, has some kind of quirky one-on-one with Lorne, where he's usually eating a basket of popcorn. He plays he holds his cards very close to the chest, and most famously, he does not laugh. He does not give cast members the satisfaction of knowing that he approves. So a lot of times people kind of come out of those auditions having no idea whether or not they've made it, because Lorne has got a pretty good poker face.
Now, SNL is known for launching the careers of comedians, movie comedic actors. Did they start doing this right from the beginning?
Yeah, you might remember that intentionally or not, Chevy Chase lasted just a year before heading out to Hollywood and trying his hand at becoming a movie star. That was not the most popular thing with his castmates and the people he left behind there. I also think he was a little bit of a tough person to work with. But immediately you see with that first cast and Chevy, this relationship that sets up SNL as a launching pad to bigger and better things. There's a kind of adage that describes SNL as the graduate school of comedy. It's where people go to perfect their craft before moving on to the big leagues, the big money of movies. And indeed, you can run down a list of the dozens of people who've had a either a short or a rather long tenure before going on and having their own talk shows, having a successful film career. And I think that's also part of what gives the show such staying power, is that we associate people like Will Ferrell and Chris Farley and Kristen Wiig and on down the line with the show that they all graduated from.
And one of the staples of Saturday Night Live is the fake commercials. Like this ad, we've got a clip here for Little Chocolate Donuts featuring John Belushi after showing him winning Olympic track and field events.
What a day for John Belushi!
I logged a lot of miles training for that day, and I downed a lot of donuts. Little chocolate donuts. They taste good, and they've got the sugar I need to get me going in the morning. That's why little chocolate donuts have been on my training table since I was a kid.
Little chocolate donuts, the donuts of champions.
Now, I will say that I've often found the fake ads to be the funniest parts of Saturday Night Live at various eras. Nick, why did that become a specialty of the show?
Yeah, that's a good question. Two reasons, really. The first is you have to remember live television, the sort of production chaos that involves putting together and performing a completely new TV show every week means you have to give cast members a break at some point to make costume changes backstage, to reorganize sets, things like that. So those pre-filmed segments, which often were the commercial bits early on, Jim Henson also had Muppet performances, Albert Brooks's short films on down the line, they served a very functional purpose to let the live broadcast sort of reset itself and get ready for the next live sketch. The second thing I think those commercial parodies tap into is really the kind of baby boomer sensibility of having grown up on television and being very literate of TV conventions and maybe skeptical of them, right? Seeing for the first time that they have a voice on TV, they can kind of talk back to it, and they were critical of TV's sort of commercial impulses. And you see that still to this day in various commercial parodies that still kind of live on. It's still a really important part of the show.
You know, Rob and I were talking before this interview about how it seemed like for a long time Saturday Night Live went in waves. It was really good. It was really hot. Everybody watched it. And I mean, everybody watched it. And then other times it seemed like nobody was watching because you knew it wasn't funny then. And then it would heat up again and someone would tell you to watch it. And then whatever they were doing on the show would become part of American speech, you know, like the church lady or making copies or something like that. Do you think it still functions like that or is it different now?
It is different now. It still has a place as a sort of cultural forum where people get together and we can expect, politicians to be showing up this election cycle. But TV just doesn't function as a national gathering spot to have conversations as much as it used to. Of course, we have social media today and our media landscape is so much more fragmented than it was in 1975 when the show premiered. Every once in a while, though, the show still has this unique ability to kind of catch pop culture lightning in a bottle. And I think you saw that most famously, most recently in 2008 with Tina Fey and Sarah Palin.
Nick, I'll jump in and let's give a listen to Tina Fey as Sarah Palin.
Like every American I'm speaking with, we are ill about this. We're saying, hey, why bail out Fannie and Freddie and not me? But ultimately, what the bailout does is help those that are concerned about the health care reform that is needed to help shore up our economy, to help. It's got to be all about job creation, too. Also, too, shoring up our economy and putting Fannie and Freddie back on the right track. And so health care reform and reducing taxes and reining in spending, because Barack Obama, you know.
So that's a case, one of many, where Saturday Night Live and politics interacted. You ended up with Sarah Palin appearing on the show. Dana Carvey's George H.W. Bush, I believe the president, made fun of himself for saying, you know, wouldn't be prudent. So how often does Saturday Night Live enter into the world of politics and back and forth like that?
Yeah, it's also a little tough to remember the pre-Daily Show, pre-Colbert Show era of comedy shows really not being all that much involved in politics. SNL was one of the first and maybe most famous. And, of course, we have political jokes on a lot of late-night talk shows. But because it's a sort of fictional, scripted sketch comedy show, it really provided a unique voice to comment on politics. It was often pretty accommodating of politicians wanting to, you know, put on a good face and willing to be lampooned to come on the show, like you saw with Sarah Palin's eventual appearance. So it cuts both ways, right? SNL greatly benefits from having politicians on the show. People tune in to see McCain and Obama and Palin on down the line. But really, we are a country, especially nowadays, that has come to really value a comedic voice, a comedic critique of our politics.
We're talking to media studies professor Nick Marks about the legacy of Saturday Night Live on the show's 40th anniversary. There's a big 3-hour special coming up on Sunday.
We want to hear from you, too. Do you have a favorite memory from SNL, a favorite cast member of all time? Do you think the sketch comedy show changed American television, for better or worse? Call in and share your thoughts and memories at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll get to your calls and continue this conversation in just a minute. First, a check of the latest headlines with Kristen Durst from WPR News.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our discussion about the legacy of Saturday Night Live as the show marks its 40th anniversary this weekend.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Your favorite memories of the show, favorite cast members, or maybe why you stopped watching it somewhere along the line. 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, one of the first skits on Saturday Night Live that really went viral was the More Cowbell sketch from the year 2000, starring Christopher Walken and Will Ferrell. Let's take a listen to that before we get to our callers. Here's one of the most popular lines from the skit.
Guess what? I got a fever. And the only prescription is more cowbell.
More cowbell. That resonates here in Wisconsin. What is it about that line in that sketch, Nick?
You know, it's funny. Presence of Will Ferrell front and center, his belly gradually being exposed as he gets more and more excited about pounding that cowbell. Jimmy Fallon cracking up in the back, right? There's so many moving parts, and that line just kind of comes out of nowhere. The heavens open up, and Christopher Walken, in his very unique sort of deadpan way, delivers it. It's just such a weird combination of elements that seemingly only live television, only live comedy television can provide.
And at live music shows, More Cowbell quickly replaced Freebird as the things audience members right. Most commonly shouted. Let's get to a caller. We've got Frank on the line in Onalaska. Frank, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, and there's an example of the music, the musical guest as being what always attracted me. I've been a fan since day one, where I'd actually stay home from going out if the musical guest was right. They'd have cutting-edge artists, new artists, you know, going back to way back, Elvis Costello, Talking Heads, which isn't always characterized by the music that they're putting on nowadays. I think they've suffered a lot by Paul Schaefer not being involved with some of that selection, which you see with his, you know, hosting David Letterman's band, where in New York they get a lot of great bands. The other thing is the guest host, where they could use their talents and the writers would rise to the occasion of writing skits specific to that guest host. And sometimes that's, you know, you've seen the return of certain guest hosts all the time because they've been good. But it's always been the music that's made it or break it for me.
Frank, thanks a lot. Nick, so two ways that the show keeps it fresh, different musical guest each week, a different guest host each week.
Yeah, it really is something we tend not to think first about when we think about SNL, the importance of music and the importance of the celebrity of the week promoting their new movie or whatever happens to be coming out for them. It's a strange relationship the show's had with music over the years. you know, they can and often did break huge new artists. They reached kind of into the underground, especially in those sort of early runs of the show in the 70s. But just like the TV landscape, the music landscape today is so fractured, and it's tough to really find that perfect artist that'll resonate with who they think the audience for the show already is. More importantly, it's tough to find a really big tent musician, somebody that everybody's going to recognize and know this is worth staying home for and worth catching SNL tonight instead of going out, like Frank was saying.
All right, let's take another quick call. Martha joins us from Menominee. Hi, Martha.
Yeah, I'm with Frank. I love the music guest, but my favorite all-time sketch that would happen would be when John Belushi would do Joe Cocker. And there was one episode where Joe Cocker was the musical guest, and Belushi came out, and they did Joe Cocker together, and Belushi did a better Joe Cocker than Joe Cocker. It was priceless.
Awesome. And, thank you for telling us about that, Martha. I've heard stories about that sketch. I've never seen it myself, but I understand it's legendary.
Yeah, of course, Belushi and Dan Aykroyd were the Blues Brothers. They were huge sort of music heads, musicians themselves. They opened up their own blues club. And a lot of that performance, a lot of that sort of parody of Cocker, I think, was done out of affection from on the part of Belushi. It wasn't necessarily making fun of Cocker, but just such a unique talent, somebody like him able to parody not just out of sort of comedic poking fun at this person, but really out of genuine affection, I think.
And Nick, we got to leave it there. Thank you so much for coming on and talking SNL today.
Thanks for having me, guys.
That was Nick Marks, assistant professor of media studies at Colorado State University. He's also the co-editor of Saturday Night Live and American TV.